This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Mark Dowdle, Superintendent of Gates of the Arctic National Park. Mark has been with the National Park Service for 24 years and started his new assignment at Gates of the Arctic in April of this year. He previously served as the Deputy Superintendent of Cape Hatteras National Seashore in North Carolina and has served as a Park Ranger Supervisor and Manager in a number of parks, including the National Parks of Boston, Yosemite National Park, Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, and Yellowstone National Park. So welcome, Mark Dowdle, up there in the Gates of the Arctic. It's great to be talking with you.
Hi, Jay. Thank you for having me on your show today. It's a great pleasure.
Great. Well, how do you like it up there north of the, in the North Country?
It's amazing, Jay. I arrived in Fairbanks in April. Fairbanks is part of the administrative headquarters of the Mid-South, the park itself. That's the bulk of our staff are located year-round. And I got here in late April after spending the winter in Cockatoo, Alaska. Acting superintendent for the other national parks. There are lots of people called the Western Arctic National Park. Those parks are to the west of Gates of the Arctic. Really referred to as next door.
So the park is located north of the Arctic Circle. Are you north of the Arctic Circle where you are?
Currently, no, because I'm in Fairbanks. Jay, I think when a lot of people think about Alaska, they think about a place that's very far to the north. Gates of the Arctic is the far north of Alaska, the park where it is entirely above the Arctic. The Arctic Alaska is defined by a very large area, which is the North Range.
So is it the only park in the U.S. national system that has no road access?
No, I think there are other parks without road access. There are definitely other parks in Alaska, such as the National Reserve, Concharles Rivers National Reserve, Lake Clark National Park, for example. But I can think of a few parks in the lower 48. Not road access, mostly islands.
Yeah, right.
Park in Florida, Channel Islands National Park in California, Isle of Royal National Park in Michigan.
Is it the Dalton or Dobson Highway that's on the east side of the park?
It is. It's called the Dalton Highway. It stretches from the north of Fairbanks all the way up to the far north. End of Alaska, Prudhoe Bay, and mostly dirt road, and it doesn't go through the park, but it does run just east of the park boundary.
So I think you can hike in to the park from the Dalton Highway?
You can. The park is very large, so starting from the Dalton Highway, you can definitely access the park that way. Depending on where you want to go, it could potentially be a very long walk.
Yeah. So, how many square miles is the park?
The park is about 13,000 square miles, and that's over 8 million acres. Land, put that in a little bit of context, that's over four times the
Yellowstone
National
Park. Oh, wow. Wow. So, how do you get up there? Since there, do you go up the Dalton Highway and somehow get in, or do you fly in, or how do you get there?
Yeah, it depends on the ultimate location. A lot of the park is accessed by the air.
A visitor, for example, could fly commercially from Fairbanks up to some of the nearby villages that are very close to the park, like Bettles and Colefoot and Mtuvik Pass.
Uh-huh.
And you could land in the park either in an airplane with wheels, but it would probably be on a pebbly beach, or an airplane with floats that could land on a river or a lake.
So how far is it as the crow flies or flying up there?
Well, it depends on what your destination is,
right.
But it's probably going to be at least several hundred miles to almost anywhere.
And what's the difference between a park and a preserve?
Yeah, there is a difference, but they are really both large natural areas protected. Really, Jay, the biggest difference is in some form of it, the lands are managed, and with a preserve, the biggest difference is that general hunting is allowed in a preserve, and only subsistence hunting would be allowed in the national park area. And for Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, only about 10% of the overall lands are preserve lands.
So indigenous people have hunting rights in both preserve and park, or just one of them?
I'm sorry, do they have what?
Indigenous people, they have hunting rights in both park and preserve, or just one of them?
Oh yes, both. Inside the national park, if they live and reside locally, they can hunt. Subsistence hunt in the park, hunting for what we call a subsistence lifestyle, to gather food, to hunt wildlife, gather berries, those types of things, to live off the land, so to speak. And they can do that both in the park and in the preserve.
So there are wilderness areas designated in that area. One of which is right within the park. What does wilderness designation do for it?
Yes, so there are over 7 million acres of land within Gates of the Arctic National Park that are what we call designated wilderness, and this designated by an act of Congress. So it is a congressionally designated wilderness area, and it has additional or special protections associated with that. It's really one of the highest levels of protection that any land area can have inside the United States. And then there is additional wilderness adjacent to Gates of the Arctic, including Noatak National Preserve, which has about 0.8 million acres of wilderness, and Kubuk Valley National Park, which has 190,000 acres of designated wilderness.
And Noatak Valley has another superintendent who's responsible for it?
Yes, sir. Noatak National Preserve has its own superintendent that is located in out of Kotzebue, Alaska, to our west.
So how often is it necessary for you to go on up into the park? And why do you go up there?
Yes, it depends. There is a need to become familiar with the places and the resources in the park, and I'm new here, so this will come in time, I know, but I'm very fortunate. There are some great people with many years of experience and knowledge to learn from. One important reason to visit the park is to interact with park staff that work at remote workstations like Bettles and Colefoot and Anatovic Pass, and it's important to hear from them, to know that they have the resources they need to do their job, and to hear firsthand about how the park is running. And then another important reason, Jay, is to visit the park, or areas adjacent to the park, is to visit local villages, tribes, and communities. And I can't express enough how important those relationships are, and the importance of hearing from local peoples about potential park management decisions that may impact their lives and traditions. And there's a tremendous amount of traditional ecological knowledge, we call it, in the local communities that have accumulated over many centuries, and this needs to be factored in the management decisions.
And how many staff people do you have located in Beatles? Is it Beatles and the other stations?
Yeah, Beatles, for example, we have two interpretive park rangers and two Interpretation Student Conservation Association interns. And we have an agreement with, we call it SCA, or Student Conservation Association, and we're able to host several interns every year. And then also in Beatles, we have one facilities as well.
Mm-hmm. So there are no roads and few trails. How do people who visit the park get around?
Yes, and Jay, there are actually no trails, no roads or no trails.
Oh, really?
As far as access, it depends really on the time of year. In the summer, visitors are either backpacking or wayfinding, you know, on foot, or possibly floating one of the many rivers. And then in the winter, people are moving through the park by dog sled or cross-country skis.
Mm. So can people access the park on the rivers coming upstream?
You can. It depends on, if you're going upstream, how navigable the waterway is, and what the level of current and that type of thing is. And the farther you get up the stream or the river, the more challenging that can be to go upriver in a watercraft.
Because it gets shallower, is that why?
Yes, it gets more shallow and the current can be stronger.
Uh-huh. So people can fly into these various villages and then can they use snowmobiles or ORVs to move around in the park?
So in the winter months, when there's adequate snow cover, snow machines are allowed. But when the snow starts to melt off, then that's just not a viable form of transportation. Off-road vehicles are not allowed. We don't have any roads, and it would essentially be there would really be no way to access.
Oh, I see.
Even. Or to get across streams or valleys or across mountains.
So tell us about the history of the park. What's its geology? How were those mountains formed? And was it part of the Bering Land Bridge? What's the history?
Yeah. Jay, that's a really big question, and I think I can begin to give that context. I think I would start with human history, and humans have lived in the Brooks Range for more than 13,000 years, and there are thousands and thousands of archaeological sites and gates of the Arctic that document this history, and people's strong connections to the land. And today, Athabascan and Inupiat descendants and various non-native Alaskan peoples call this area home. And traditionally, populations were small and mobile, and they moved throughout the year among series of camps to harvest seasonally available foods, and it was really not until the last century that people settled in permanent year-round villages. And today there are 11 what we call resident zone communities directly associated with the park, and many of these people continue those hunting traditions to conduct subsistence activities within around the park and preserve. And then also talking about human history, more recent, the first European visitors came to Central Brooks Range in the 1880s. These were military explorers assigned to map this uncharted territory, and they struggled up the rivers and over the mountain passes and followed following them are prospectors searching for signs of gold, and they survived the long winters in rough mining camp. And then government scientists came to examine and record the natural and cultural history of really this previously undocumented place. And then, of course, more recently, the recreational adventurers that are seeking, you know, wild places, and certainly Gates of the RA provides that. And then, Jay, when we talk about geology, the whole park can preserve, protect a landscape that encompasses the Brooks Range, as I mentioned, and this is completely north of the Arctic Circle, and like much of Alaska, these mountains were formed when large sections of the Earth's crust called terrains were transported here by the process of plate tectonics, and hiding within the layers of these terrains there can be fossils of once living organisms from throughout history. Some of these are as old as 400 million years. It's really amazing. And then this tectonic activity, many of the peaks of the park, like the Ergatch peaks, started out as magma below the Earth's surface, and this slowly cooled over time to become solid rock-hold granite. And this granite was uplifted by the collision of the plates, and the rocks above it were eroded away by the forces of the Earth's surface. And one of these big forces was glaciers, and much of the Brooks Range during the last ice age were covered by glaciers, unlike a lot of interior Alaska, which was actually ice-free during that time. And these glaciers out the sharp peaks, ridges, and valleys, and lakes, and left behind, you know, trace deposits of, you know, this glacial history and retreat, and really shaped the landscape that we see today.
So there was magma that was formed beneath the surface, but there was none that broke through as volcanoes. Is that right?
Yeah, not necessarily called volcanoes so much, but you know, this did. I don't know to what degree, but I think there was some volcanism, but not as much as in some other places like the Cascade Range and in the western United States. And then, Jay, you did mention the Barren Bridge. If I could touch on that, because this is a really interesting story and part of the history of Alaska, and some call this the lost continent of Beringia. It's really not so mythical land that disappeared beneath the Bering and Chukchi Sea during the last ice age. And there were two big ice sheets that covered much of Canada and the northern United States, and these ice sheets trapped a lot of water, so much so that the level of the seas dropped and exposed a pathway between Siberia and Alaska, and people moved across this new land, and that's where the first Alaskans came from.
So what's the high point, in the Brooks Range?
Yeah, the highest point in the park is Mount Ikapak, and it's 8,510 feet high. And then not too far from that, also in the southwest area, the lowest point in the park, which is about 289 feet above sea level along the Kokluk River.
So Agiak Lake is that a major feature in the park? Where's it located?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a relative low lake. It's just south of the Continental Divide in the kind of the more northern end of the park. And but I think what's significant about the lake is that it's the headwaters for Agiak Creek and the John River, which is a designated wild and scenic river. And Jay, inside Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, we have six wild and scenic rivers designated.
Wow. So the Brooks Range makes up the bulk of the park. What's the Brooks Range like? What's the landscape look like?
Yes, you're correct. It comprises a large, we call this the Central Brooks Range, and it stretches east-west across the park, and the south side of the Brooks Range is within what we call the boreal forest, or the northern forest. It's a mosaic of diverse plant communities. It has swaths of spruce trees and aspen and birch, and it's all braided together with shrub thickets and meadows and boggy muskegs. And then at the higher elevations, you have those landscapes of bedrock and scree and snowfields and glaciers, and mentioned the Arrogance Peaks. This makes up, you know, the tallest, the height in the park, and the most rugged mountains along the south boundary of the park. And then, Jay, north of the Continental Divide, you'll find harsh weather, and there's a lot of permafrost near the surface, and that prevents a lot of growth of forest. So here the land gives way to sprawling tundra landscape, and this is dominated by low shrub grassy tussocks.
So down here in the lower 48, the Continental Divide separates Pacific drainage from Atlantic drainage. What does it divide? What does it separate up there?
Yeah, well, it's the similar concept. So you have waters flowing to the west out towards the Chukchi Sea, and then you also have waters flowing to the south down towards the Yukon River.
Oh. Okay. So does any flow north to the Arctic? The Arctic Ocean?
They do flow north. I don't know if they all the way, if those waters exit to the far north, or if they kind of make their way more westerly. I'm not sure, Jay.
Just north of the park is called the North Slope, and then there's also, I guess, just east of that, the National Petroleum Preserve. That Dalton Highway runs up to the National Petroleum Reserve, right?
It does. It goes up to Prudhoe Bay, and you are correct. The National Petroleum Reserve and the area we call the North Slope is to the north of Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve.
And what are the unique characteristics of the National Petroleum Preserve?
Yeah, I'm less familiar with that area.
Okay.
I haven't visited there yet. Certainly there have been large reserves of petroleum found there, you know, under the surface of the land. But as I was describing, the areas north of the Continental Divide is more of an open tundra landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Has lots of small waterways and just a lower vegetation in general.
What agency of government regulates the or is responsible for the National Petroleum Preserve?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Jay. There are a number of different agencies and state lands that surround the park. The Bureau of Land Management manages a lot of those lands. And then there are also a number of wildlife refuges in Alaska managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then there are also native lands, native corporation lands, and state of Alaska lands as well.
What are the seasonal differences that take place up in that country, and how long do they run?
Yeah, well, Jay, there are definite seasons in the park, and spring and fall tend to be short. Rain begins in May generally, and this includes thaw, as we call it, and that's, you know, the melting of snow and the melting of ice along the rivers and lakes, and then we'll green up, which are the new green growth coming out on trees and shrubs. And then fall begins as early as mid-August, and, you know, this is, we have just amazing fall colors during this time of year, and then, of course, between spring and fall is the long days of summer, where we have 24 hours of daylight for pretty much May through July, and then mm-hmm. you know the winters are long with you know dark days and or you know a lot of darkness during the day, and that generally there's not much or very light between November and January, so it's a land of extremes throughout the year.
So are there any trees in the park?
Oh yes. There are spruce trees and birch, and these are all braided together with willow shrub thickets throughout.
And what other kinds of flora dominate in the park?
Yeah, Jay, there are about 600 species of tular plants in case of the Arctic, and some examples would be hawksbeard, cottongrass, Siberian aster, mountain harebell, over 600 species. So it's quite diverse. You think about the far north and you don't realize how much diversity there is for wildlife and for plants.
Mm. And there are mountain peaks in the park, in the Endicott Mountains and Schwatka Mountains, is that right?
Yes, yeah. I don't think we really know how many mountains there are. It's such a vast wilderness, and only a few are named or well-known. Jay, when we talk about mountains, maybe this is a good time to mention where the park's name came from.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are familiar with wilderness advocate Bob Marshall, and he would go up to the park in the late 20s and the 1930s, and he would travel the North Fork of the Koyukuk River country, and he saw two peaks. One's called Frigid Crags, and the other is Boreal Mountain, and he described this as the gates from Alaska's Central Brooks Range into the far North Arctic. So that's where the name Gates of the Arctic comes from.
Do mountain climbers need permits to conduct expeditions there?
Yeah, permits are not required generally to access the park. It may depend on what they're doing. If they were, depending on how they were accessing the park or what specific activity they were doing, the permit could potentially be required, but generally for recreational access permits are not required.
Uh-huh. And but climbers, I assume, would need climbing equipment to scale those peaks?
It depends. I mentioned the Ergetch peaks earlier. They're much steeper. I would imagine that technical climbing gear would be needed to mm-hmm. really climb on those, but you know there are other mountains that you could walk on or up and over that are more rugged and not quite as steep.
Mm-hmm. Mark, we have exhausted our time, and I've got a lot of questions still to ask, so if we could do another session, I would certainly like to do that. Would that work for you?
Jay, I would love to join you again another time. It's been my pleasure today, and yes, let's do this again.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much. Our guest today has been Mark Dowdle, Superintendent of the Gates of the Arctic National Park up in Alaska. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.